Lag Ba'Omer. Lag Ba'Omer. So today is Lag Ba'Omer. I have to tell you about it because in Israel it's certainly very different than it is abroad. First of all, let's start with what the halachists say about Lag Ba'Omer. The halachists tell us that the period of time between Pesach and Shavuot is a time in which we practice some level of mourning in commemoration of the death of Rabbi Akiva's students, which ceased at Lag Ba'Omer. So therefore, Lag Ba'Omer, as it says in the Sefer Halacha, it's noe ketzat simcha, some joy. Okay? And of course, it's a session of mourning. Now that, what does that have to do with what goes on in Israel? The huge bonfires, the pilgrimage to Miron, to Shimon HaTzadik, to Rabbi Akiva. What's the big deal? So there are two things that we have to talk about when talking about Lag Ba'Omer. One is the period of time itself. The days when the Jews got out of Egypt before the days they received the Torah. The period of Sfira. And what happened on the 33rd day of Sfira. The next thing we have to talk about is Rabbi Akiva, his students, and their deaths. And why not dying is a reason to celebrate. They were all dead. The reason they stopped dying is they were gone. There was nobody else to die. And the third thing is that this is also the anniversary of the death of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. We would have to talk about the significance of his life, its connection to Rabbi Akiva's life, and to the death of Rabbi Akiva's students, and why this is a time of joy. So let's talk about these ideas one by one. First, the period of time. When the Jews left Egypt, they had seen great miracles, miracles that we can't even begin to take in. For us, they stay in our minds. For them, they lived it. It's a whole different thing. But even when you live something, if it's to become you, and not just something you know and something you feel, but something you are, there's a process. I want to illustrate to you how this process works. Years ago, we lived in a moshav, Segev, and during the Yom Kippur War, we were so distant physically from the rest of Israel that we didn't know there was a war because we weren't connected to the civil defense system, so there was no siren. Later in the day, the army came to take the men who thought that there was really no war and therefore only left after Yom Kippur because they thought it was just a random call-up and they were religious. The closest Jewish moshav to us was a place called Yodfat, very secular, so secular that once they did a spiritual evening and they invited monks from an Arab village, Diyar Chana, to speak to them. Now that's, you know, as in England they say, it's OTT, which means over the top. Okay, so their men, of course, went on Yom Kippur for the call-up, and because of that, they came back a day earlier than the men of Segev. So we got a call on the village phone. In those days, people didn't have individual phones. And they said, if you want to hear what's really going on, they'll be coming home today at whatever time. We wanted to know. We were very concerned because by that point, it was several days into the war, 3 days into the war, everybody heard enough through the grapevine that things were going not well. And they were. In those few days, over 1,000 soldiers were killed. Nobody knew the extent of how bad things were. And on the radio, they were lying to us, and we knew that they were lying to us. So we wanted to know the truth. So we walked over the hills to Yodfat. When we got there, virtually everyone from Yodfat and we from Segev were in the living room of a woman. Soon thereafter, the soldiers came in. They came in straight from the war. The eldest of them, who was 30, which at the time seemed very old to me, okay, which now seems very young to me, but in any case, he was the spokesman, and he said, "We saw miracles." And someone said, "What do you mean?" We were all in cognitive dissonance. And he said, "Remember when we were children, we learned the Bible is literature, which is how it's taught in secular schools, and we learned 10 people will pursue 100, and 100 will pursue 10,000. That's what happened. The first day of the war, they could have taken Sfat. They were near enough. It would have been a horrific bloodbath. They stopped before, even though there was still plenty of daylight. It was as though they were waiting for us, and then they ran away from us. So everybody was dumbstruck. Everyone believed him. This man had no agenda to describe something as a miracle from God based on previous religious belief or affiliation. Everyone in the room believed him. Tens of people. Only two people changed their lives appreciably. But I want to tell you, and this is why I'm telling you this story, I saw the moment when it was clear to me that nobody was going to change very much. The woman of the house, very appropriately and correctly, turned to the soldiers and said, "Do you want coffee?" And they said, "Yes." And that led to with milk, without milk, with sugar, without sugar. It was gone. The moment was gone. Because we go easily back into our pre-existent patterns. Now, how are these patterns established? They're established through actions. So if there isn't an action and a choice made, then no matter how inspired you are to give in time, it's going to leave you in the end because it's superficial. You have to take the inspiration and integrate it through choices, through choice making. So when the Jews left Egypt, they saw it all. They were inspired. They were more inspired than we could even imagine being. But they needed time to integrate it through actions. What they had to deal with in this time period was themselves. There's a famous saying, it's attributed to George Patton, the famous general. I don't know if he's the one who said it or not. But he was supposed to have quoted, I think it was Napoleon, who said, "We've met the enemy and he's ours." And he said, "We've met the enemy and he's us. We are our enemies. In maintaining awareness and inspiration, we're our own enemies." So what did God do to give us the ability to integrate our inspiration? He gave us a period of time between our exodus from Egypt, when we were still very much in terms of the world of action, we were acting in accordance with our old patterns. Thought, feeling, we were in a different place. Actions, we had our patterns. And our patterns are symbolized by barley, which then was animal food. And because of that, the sacrifice offered then was a sacrifice of barley. We had to move towards being choice makers, to being fully human. On Shavuot, the sacrifice is wheat, human food. The process is one in which we have to change our midot, our character traits, and move them out of our old patterns. This period of time is called Sfirat HaOmer. Okay, so what does this have to do with Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day of Omer? Why is that different than, let's say, the 42nd day of Omer, or the 22nd day of Omer? So the events that happened on Lag BaOmer, in fact, open us and give us a certain access to experience that changed everything for us. What happened on Lag BaOmer? So there's something that happened in the desert, and then we could begin to talk about Rabbi Akiva and his students. The Chasam Sofer maintains that Lag BaOmer was the day in which the man began to fall. They took 3 days' worth of food out of Egypt, and then, okay, 30 days later, excuse me, 30, they took 30 days' worth of food out of Egypt, okay, the man began to fall. So what? So what that means is that they were taking God into their experience, into their food, into their eating. The Gemara tells us that the Torah could only be given to people who ate man. What does that mean? No matter how inspired people were by events, until they actually internalized it physically, that God is the provider, that they could trust His word, that He's the master of all reality, nothing happened. So because of this, that day changed us internally enough to receive Torah. However, and this is why we're not going to stay at that with this very long, that's not what it says in the Sifrei Halacha. As we said, the Sifrei Halacha tell us we celebrate this day with Ketzat Simcha doesn't say a word about the Mun. So what did happen? So this takes us back to Rabbi Akiva's students. So when a tragedy stops, we don't usually celebrate, especially since there was no dramatic rescue. What's this about? So there are two things to focus on. One is Rabbi Akiva, and the other is his students. Let's focus on his students first. He had 12,000 pairs of students, meaning 24,000 students in all. Okay, these students died of an illness in which they choked to death. So whether it was something like whooping cough or croup, we don't know, but that was the sort of illness. Why did they die, and why through that means? So the fact is, of course, that everybody is going to die in the end. So, but when you're talking about what deaths that take place in a way that's so clearly not just part of the game, surely there's a message we should learn. And indeed, the Talmud tells us what the message is. The Talmud tells us that the message is that they died because they weren't nahogu kavod ze bezeh. They didn't treat each other with respect. Now realize who we're talking about. We're talking about Rabbi Akiva's students. We're not talking about kids in a playgroup. I'm sure they didn't spit at each other, call each other names, hit each other. I'm sure that the vocabulary that we see today in politics was not the vocabulary they used. Let's talk about being noheg kavod. Kavod means taking someone seriously. The root of the word kavod is the word kaved, which means heavy. They didn't take each other seriously enough. Let's talk about taking someone seriously. If you want to show someone that you take them seriously, what do? So there are all sorts of things. Eye contact, not walking away while they're still talking. Those are externals. But internally, that means really looking at them and say, this person has a message. Let me listen to what they have to say. I'm going to learn something from this person. This person is enormously significant. Now, what would make anybody enormously significant? Let's pretend that animals gave birth in the hospital. So you go to the hospital one day, you go to the baby department, the neonatal department, and you see all of the little giraffes in a row, you know, tiny little giraffes, and their little tiny cots, and they're so cute, and they're pink giraffes and blue giraffes, okay, what in terms of their blankets. Could you predict their futures? Could you or not? Of course. Their lives are going to be very much collectively describable. They're all going to eat grass. They're all going to eat leaves. They're all going to live a prescribed number of years, more or less. And the same would hold true for any animal. You could pretty much chart their future from day one. Now let's go into an actual infant department, a neonatal ward. You go to visit Hadassah today. You see maybe 23 babies. Blue blankets, pink blankets. Could anyone know which one of them is going to be a noble person? A person that will be remembered generations after for his character? And which person will end up being somebody who's easily forgotten because he accomplished nothing in life? And which one will be a person who will be remembered, but every time you hear his name, it'll be with a shudder? We can't know that. The difference is that they could achieve comes from the part in them that deserves honor. That part is the soul. So on the outside, in their bodies, they're all the same, but inside they're all different, which is not the case with animals. Rabbi Akiva's students didn't appreciate that everyone who they encounter is infinite and has something to say that nobody else has ever said and has an approach that nobody else has ever taken, because no two people are the same. Why should that lead them to choking to death? So when a person, lo aleinu, not that we should know from such things, chokes, what happens is that their ability to take in air is blocked. They can't take in air. A person who can't give kavod to another person has stopped taking in spirit. The word for air in Hebrew and the word for spirit, for wind and spirit, are the same word. They're both ruach. A person who doesn't give kavod to another person has lost their ability to take in ruach. Now, as true as this is for everyone, we should give kavod to every person. Why? What does it say in Pirkei Avos? There's no person who doesn't have their hour. So that means it could be objectively true that there are people who at a given time we have not much to learn from, but there's going to be a moment we'll see something in them, if we keep our eyes open, that we'll never have access to seeing in anybody else. But kal v'chomer, when you're talking about tzaddikim and when you're talking about talmidei chachamim, the necessity to give them kavod is huge. Why? Because their spirits are entwined with Torah. How does this work? If you talk about really knowing somebody, really knowing someone means knowing their thoughts. When you learn Torah, you're learning Hashem's thought. So at that moment, your mind and Hashem's mind are entwined. So when you give kavod to a Talmud Chacham, because he's a Talmud Chacham, then what you're really giving kavod to is Hashem himself. Hashem's thought, his divinity, is flows through another person. Now you could say, well, why should I honor a person? I could honor God, but why honor a person regardless of how learned or pious the person is? They're not God. They're only human, which is, of course, true. And just as an aside, Rav Avadi Yosef maintains that you have to give honor to a learned woman. The reason for this is that God's infinite, and we could see who he is as it translates through the middos of people who are great. So you have to look for greatness even in simple people. Simple people have enormous greatness. There's great beauty in almost everybody who you'll encounter. But certainly when you encounter somebody whose mind and God's mind are entwined, there's great beauty. But the way God translates himself through a Talmud Chacham is through that person's individual character, that person's individual life experience, that person's individual language, that person's individual age and presence. So the Torah that you learn from person A isn't at all identical to the Torah you learn from person B. Now here's where this gets sticky. This gets sticky in this, that we tend to identify truth as somehow monolithic. So if somebody else's wisdom doesn't jive with ours, we tend to be very dismissive. Maharal says that the source of the problem is as follows. When God created the world, he invoked all of his attributes. He asked kindness, shall I create a world? Chesed said, yes. He asked justice. Justice was very equivocal. He asked emes, and emes said, no. Why? Because since humans can't see the whole picture, which we can't because we live short lives and we're subjective, Emma said, there's no place for me in Adam. Adam will never know me. So what did Hashem do? He picked up Emes, tossed it to the world forcefully so that it shattered. So there are tiny bits of Emes all over. And concerning this, it says in Tehillim, Emet min ha'aretz titzmach. So Maharal points out that people find Emes in the form that they find it. The point that resonates to them, their emes. Now, emes is the whole picture, realize. So they see the whole picture as it translates through them and their midos and their experience. So what they're seeing really is emes. But somebody else will not see it through their eyes. They'll see it through whose eyes? Their own eyes. So the emes of Hillel and Shammai was the same emes, but the way Hillel saw it was different because he's Hillel, and the way Shammai saw it was different because he was Shammai. So it's not that they were looking at two different things. They were looking through two different lenses at the same thing. That's why we could say, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, both his and her and the other men's, is the word of the living God. But intuitively, we think that the emes that we see through our own eyes is the emes in its pure state, which means what the other person says is what we project as being what? Not emes. This was the problem of Rabbi Akiva's students. So they had two problems. One was not seeing the other one's view as emes, and the other is the fact that they have to treasure the emes that comes from another source, dafka, because it's from another source, because it gives them a stronger grasp on infinity. Now there's another problem. The other problem is that the higher a person is in their search for truth, the more relevant emes is to them. So saying Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim is only relevant if you're sure the other person is looking at what's true. They're seeing it through their eyes, but are you sure what they're looking at is true? That's completely different than being vague, approximate, or uncaring about what the other person is looking at. So there's a vast difference between saying Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim and saying, well, as long as you have your truth and I have my truth, and I'll respect you, and you'll respect me. That means I don't care where the truth lives. You didn't examine your truth, you didn't examine the other person's truth. Be real. So Dafka Rabbi Akiva's students, because of their level, had trouble giving kavod zeh lazeh. And the effect wasn't just on the other person. The effect was on the person who didn't give kavod. Why? Because he lost what the other person could have contributed to his own emes. To understand this in greater depth, in Shaar HaGilgulim, the Arizal talks about the progression of souls. He says that the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva were in fact Gilgulim, reincarnations of the 24,000 people who died when they committed the sin of Baal Peor. So just to refresh you on Baal Peor, who you probably haven't thought about recently. Okay, when the Jews were in the desert, the Moabites wanted to destroy them. They recognized after the failure of Bilam to curse them that they can't destroy them physically, so they wanted to destroy them from within spiritually. So they had their daughters entice the Jewish men into worship of a specific idol called Baal Peor. What was this idol? This idol was one in which people who adhered to the beliefs represented by this idol worshipped human waste. Isn't that bizarre? What were they worshipping? How did anybody get involved in this? So, to understand this in some depth, realize there are two ways that people could relate to each other. One is looking for each other's kavod, looking for what's real and should be taken seriously in the other person and treasuring it and integrating it. And at that point you feel bonded to the other person and love them. The other is looking for the lowest possible common denominator, coarseness, vulgarity, transience, and bonding on that level. When you look at today's world and you examine the art, the literature, certainly the music, metal, rock, okay, whatever. That's where people find their bond oftentimes in today's culture. The cultural bond is giving people attachment to everything that's horrific that they share in common deeply. So if you listen to the words of the worst rock, if you look at the worst art, which is often the most popular art, the most popular music. If you look at the literature that goes, that's what you'll see. I remember years ago reading a book by Truman Capote in Cold Blood, and the theme of it was a careful study of a killer, a person who had done a mass murder, and what was going on inside of him. The result being that when you read the book, you realize that you're not that different than him. That there are drives in him that parallel and reflect drives that you have. And of course, you end up feeling more sympathetic towards him. We live in a time in which love and tolerance, which are beautiful values, have translated to some degree into what the worship of Baal Peor brought forth in people. Loving people not for their nobility, but for its opposite. Not for their self-transcendence, but for its opposite. So they die. They were given another chance, which is what reincarnation is all about. The tikkun would have been giving kavod to each other, and they failed. Now, is that something to celebrate? So most of us would say, no. Maybe a reason for introspection. It may be a reason for fasting, but celebration? So the reason why there's a place for celebration is that Rabbi Akiva started again. Rabbi Akiva started again. He gathered 5 new students. Could you realize the courage that that took? He gathered 5 new students and taught them. And it's from this that we have our entire oral tradition. Everything would have been lost had Rabbi Akiva given in to the natural depression and sense of failure that the death of his students must have brought about within him. From that perspective, we see the significance of one of Rabbi Akiva's teachings. Amar Rabbi Akiva, V'ahavta l'rayacha kamocha, ze klal gadol b'Torah. Rabbi Akiva says, love your neighbor as you love yourself. It's a great rule in Torah. What do we mean when we say it's a great rule in Torah? And Shabbos is a minor rule in Torah. Don't murder is nothing. What do you mean it's a great rule in Torah? Maharal explains, using the pasuk in Mishlei, Ve'acha v'rea avicha al tazov, don't abandon your friend or your father's friend. Quoting the Talmud, he says, the friend who you mustn't abandon is God. The place that you find God is in the heart of another person and in the mind of another person. Don't abandon your friend. Don't abandon the lessons that you learned from people before you. Not your Reya and not Reya Avicha. No one should be abandoned. For that, and in that sense, it's Klal Gadol B'Torah. The whole Torah hangs on it. The whole Torah is taking you to a place where you could find God. And the first place you could find him is in another person. So Lag BaOmer is the day that we begin this again. Now let's connect this with the Man for a moment. The Man gave us an experiential grasp of godliness. Rebeginning. Today was the day of the new beginning. The new beginning was the day, again, of getting an experiential grasp on Torah. Not just knowing, but finding it experientially in the heart and in the mind of the other person. It's not coincidental that this happens to be the 33rd day of Omer. Okay, Gal Einai V'Abita Nifla'ot B'Toratecha. Open my eyes, reveal my eyes, let my sight be revealed, meaning let it not be blocked, that I see the wonders of your Torah. To Pasuk and Tehillim. Gal is the gematria of Lamed Gimel. Okay, 33. This is the day where your eyes could be opened. In what sense could your eyes be opened? It's not all in your mind, and it's not all in your heart. It has to be in your relationships. It has to be in your experience. Then you could see the wonders of Torah. Then it's all open before you. But until you let your eyes open to that, it's not all open before you. It isn't. This is also why Bnei Yisachar points out the word Tov in Gematria, okay, is 17. Okay, so Tov, the idea of this being 17 days, okay, before Matan Torah, okay, is taking us also to a recognition of this, that we have to progress in this further. Now let's talk about Shimon Bar Yochai. Shimon Bar Yochai was one of the students of Rabbi Akiva, the new students, one of the 5. Okay, his life was fascinating, as you know. What was his life about? His life was about becoming more and more intimately involved in Torah, Okay, and Hashem, on his side, gave him opportunities to reach deeper and deeper into himself to discover this. So you're all familiar with the story of how Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai had to take refuge from the Romans by hiding in a cave with his son Elazar. And only after 12 years did he come out. When he came out, he didn't get it yet. What's the proof that he didn't get it? It says that when he came out, he saw a person planting a field. What did he see when he saw a person planting a field? What he saw was a wasted life. You spend your days planting, and then what? You have to harvest. And then what? You have to process. And after you process, you have to eat. And then you have enough strength to what? To plant. What's it all for? So the Gemara says that the fire in his gaze burnt the person. What did God say then? Back to the cave. A year later he came out. He pleaded with God. He said, even the wicked in Gehenna are only punished with 12 months. I've already had my 12 years. Let me out. The cave wasn't an easy place to be. In spite of the fact that he had food from a carob tree, water from a brook that passed by, wasn't an easy place to be. It wasn't just the isolation. But on every possible level, it was hard. His body was full of sores. It was a terrible place to be. Came out, and he saw a man carrying two hadassim and myrtles. He said, what are you doing? So I'm carrying them to dance before a bride. He got it! As you say in modern Hebrew, nafal ha'asimon. He got it. He got it. This simple man has something to teach him. What he has to teach him has to do not with escape from the world, but what? Uplifting the world. That meaning is there in the world, and that ordinary people could discover it through observing the Torah. He got it. Now, during the time in the cave, he learned the secrets of the Torah. When he got out, he gathered to him a group of students who were referred to as the Idra, the community of students. There were 10 of them. They were hand-picked. On what basis did he select them? So each one of them had a unique and specific trait. A different sphera was the predominant one in his soul. One was a person of chesed, one was a person of gvura, another a person of tiferet. All 10 attributes of Hashem were in the Idra. The reason why he made the selection on that basis was he came to grips with the uniqueness of contribution, the beauty of difference, as long as what you're studying is what? True. So what did he teach them, and what are secrets of the Torah? What on earth does this have to do with us? So secrets of the Torah, the Gra tells us, is as follows. When you see the king from a distance, what you see is the crown and his royal garments. As you come closer, you see the outline of the king's body against the garments. As you come closer still, if you were his wife, you would see his body. So the pshat of Torah is the outside. The sod of Torah is the inside. It tells you not about how Hashem is expressed through the world and through the mitzvah, but who he is in essence in terms of his body, kivyachol. His soul will never be known to us. So teaching the secrets of Torah, the divine names, ways in which we could describe Hashem, he was teaching people how divinity looks so that they could discover it where? In themselves and in others. And this is why he said, I'm for everyone. He didn't say, I'm for this exclusive group of the Idra. He said, I'm for everyone. In what sense? People like us can't learn secrets of Torah. We could barely see the outside outlines of the garments. What did he mean when he said it's for everyone? So what he meant is two things. One is that everyone has some relationship to it. So the same way Moshe, who gave us all of the revealed Torah, there's a spark of Moshe within all of us. We don't know Moshe's place of burial. It says in Zohar, it's hidden from all hiddenness. It's as hidden as God himself, so to speak. okay, in order that we not turn him into an idol. Shimon bar Yochai, who brought down to this world by writing and teaching, as opposed to concealing the secrets of the Torah, there's a spark of him within us also. There's a spark of us that wants meaning, and that will find Hashem. We'll find it in the heart of the other person. We'll find it in our own hearts. Reb Shimon said, I'm for everyone. Okay, and he told something very interesting. He said, come to me on the day of my festival. His festival, the word for festival is Hilula. If any of you who are listening are Sephardim, you'll know what a Hilula is. A Hilula is the anniversary of a death. Reb Shimon said, come to me on the day of my death and come with Simcha. Now, what's so joyous about the day of his death? Mele his birthday, the day he came out of the cave, the day of his death. So for tzaddik, each year after their death, there's a higher and higher and higher level of revelation. So you could say, well, you know, he's been dead almost 1,900 years. In fact, over 1,900 years, he was from the second century. He's already had a lot of revelation. But Hashem is infinite. There's always more and higher. And he says, I'll take you with me. But he made a condition, share my joy. Now, how could you share his joy? What do we have to do with him? Our level and his level? What do they have to do with each other? They're two different worlds. So, no, you could go with him. You could do what he did, which is to find kavod, to find Hashem in other people, in yourself, in experiences, and let his merit take you higher. Now, you could say, how could his merit take you higher? So I want to tell you a rule that Maharal says. This isn't just about Rav Shimon bar Yochai, but this is a rule about all tzaddikim and their tombs. He says, first of all, after, quoting the Zohar, after a tzaddik's death, in a certain sense, it's easier to make a real kesher with him, a real connection with him, than in his lifetime. Why? Because in his lifetime, he's constrained by his own physicality, time and place. After death, where there's no body, there's no constraint. Another thing is that for ordinary people, when they die, because their body oftentimes was a source of their defeat, their souls and their spirit want to fly free of their bodies. So for people like us, it's shalom v'lo lehitra'ot. Goodbye, I don't want to see you again until the final rectification. For the tzaddikim who succeeded in rectifying their physical realities in their own lifetime, for the tzaddikim who use their bodies well, some aspect of their spirit is always with their actual bodies at their resting place. So this is why the tomb of tzaddikim is holy. This is why Kalev ben Yefuna, when he entered Israel, knew that the way he could be saved from falling into the trap of not trusting Hashem that the other Meraglim fell into, even though they were tzaddikim in their own right, he knew no matter how righteous he was, he could fall. So what did he do? He went to the tomb of the patriarchs in Hebron and implored them to use their merit to protect him. And he was the only one who was protected on that basis. Yehoshua, who also didn't fail, was protected by Moshe, who changed his name from Hoshea to Yehoshua. So the idea there is that a tzaddik could give you something of himself because he's there and he wants to give. But there's a however. The degree to which you identify with the tzaddik is the degree to which the tzaddik identifies with you, Maharal tells us. So that means you could have two people going to the tomb of the patriarchs in Hebron, for instance. And I've seen this, it's so tragic. People go with good intentions, they want to be inspired, that's why they're there. It's at least, to some degree, peripherally dangerous to go there. I'm not saying it's absolutely dangerous or forbidden, I go there. But it's certainly not like staying in your own little home. So people get on the bus, make the journey, and then they have some tour guide who'll say, the stones that are close to the tomb itself are of Herodian, origin, you could see the Herodian signature by the lines that give definition to, okay, who cares? What the tour guide should be saying is, go in, throw yourself on the tombs, there's Avraham. There's the one who's the source of all chesed in the world. Without him, there'd be no chesed in the world. It only comes through him. He's the conduit. Here's Yitzchak, who taught us what self-sacrifice is, and what meaning is, and what kesher is. Here's Yaakov, the source of all truth. Plead with them. Find them in yourself, but that's not what you hear. So similarly, on Lag BaOmer, when people go to the tombs of the great tzaddikim, to Miron, what are they doing? They're saying, Rabbi Shimon, you brought great light into the world. You brought the Sodos HaTorah. You brought the hidden Torah, the Pnimius HaTorah, into the world. I want to see Pnimius. I want to see good in myself and in other people. And he says he'll take the tefillah with you, your tefillah with him, meaning, and in the merit of this, give me the tools I need. Give me what I need in life. So for one person, that might be healing. For another person, that might be a shidduch. For another person, it might be a personal yeshua from within themselves. Whatever it is. That's what Lag BaOmer is in Miron. And in Miron, you have the opportunity to live in Lag BaOmer. So I don't know how many of you have actually been there. But when you go to Miron, it's as though you walk into a whole other place in time. And to three holidays at once. When you get there, so the bus leaves you off at the bottom of the hill. So because everybody knows many people will be coming, there's certainly no secret there. Okay, there are people who are selling all sorts of things there. When I say all sorts of things, I mean everything from the Sefer Zohar with the Perush Matok Kedvash in installments, okay, to nightgowns, slippers, candy. There'll be people who are giving you food and drinks without your asking because they want to use the opportunity to give, to draw down compassion from above. Have some petel, have some cola, have some water. Do you want hot? Here's a thing for hot. You want cold? Here's a thing for cold. The atmosphere is like a Mideastern bazaar. It's hectic, it's colorful, and if you're not a certain kind of person, you could say, who needs this? I feel a migraine coming. Okay, you walk up further, and as you get up further, you'll see, again, pictures of tzaddikim being sold, all sorts of means of trying to attach. The Breslovers are there in full force since they believe that Reb Nachman was an incarnation of Reb Shimon and thus Moshe. The Chabads are there, but others are there as well. You go up further, you're now in front of the tomb, it's very crowded, and you hear the music. There's dancing there 24 hours, from the beginning of Lag BaOmer at night till the very end, till close to Ma'ariv. The Yerushalmi clarinetists, the wall-to-wall dancing, Hasidim, Sfaradim, other people, ordinary people, yeshiva guys, dancing together continually, sharing the joy of Reb Shimon. So what was Purim a few minutes ago down the hill, suddenly you're in Simchas Torah. And if you have the fortitude for it, because getting into the kever when there were only 250,000 other people who have the same idea requires a certain amount of fortitude, what you'll do next is you'll find somebody who looks like they're a pusher, put yourself in back of her, and flow with her, because the crowds will be pushing you from the back, until you get into the actual tomb. You get into the actual tomb and there's no more Simchas Torah there. When you're there, you're at Ne'ilah. When you're there, the seriousness, not the sadness, but the seriousness and the earnestness of the tefillah is something that one rarely sees. And you could stay there, and you could say Tehillim, you could say Tikkun, you could say Mincha, if you're the kind of person who could daven Mincha in a focused way in that kind of a crowd, which I'm not sure I could. Okay, and then when you're out, there's the Simcha, and it's all around you. And you could stay there for an hour and float with it. And when you're ready, you can go down to the bottom, and the vendors, and the cheapness, and the sleaze, and it's okay. because you've taught yourself to see what's good and what's beautiful in the people. And you get on the bus and you go home and it could last you a whole year. So this is what Lag BaOmer in Miron is about. But if you're not in Miron, naniach, or you can't handle Miron, which is certainly reasonable. So in Eretz Yisrael, people go to the other tzaddikim. They go to Rabbi Akiva, who was, of course, Rabbi Shimon's Rebbe. They go to Shimon HaTzadik, who was a person of such spiritual grandeur that the Roman emperor of his time, okay, the Grecian of his time, saw him as a person of great holiness. But let's say you're not there. Let's say you're in Cleveland or Detroit. So, as far as I recall, I may be wrong on this, even the large fires, which are like giant Yahrzeit candles for Reb Shimon, celebrating the light of his soul and of his Torah, even that you can't do there, because, as I recall, it might have changed since I was young, but the fire department didn't let people make bonfires when I was growing up. So then it has to be in your heart. But don't let that discourage you. It says in Tehillim, V'nasata simcha b'libi, Perek Dalet, I think. Okay, Hashem put simcha in your heart. And just by willing it to be there and finding the place within you that responds to this, okay, there's place for simcha on Lag BaOmer. Now, how do we bring it into our lives on a more regular basis? So the Arizal already saw in his time that Rav Shimon's writings have to be watered down so that other people understand it. Today, everybody learns Pnimius HaTorah, only people don't call it that in order not to confuse us so that we don't think we're Kabbalists, as they would call it. But anybody who reads Mechtav Me'Eliyahu is reading things that come from the Maharal and from the Hasidic sources, which in turn come ultimately from Rav Shimon's teachings via the Arizal and others. Anybody who listens to Rav Moshe Shapiro's tapes, anybody who listens to anything that touches the side of meaning, in the end, is coming to the source, the great light that came into the world through Rav Shimon, whose Hilula we celebrate on Lag BaOmer. So this is something that touches all of us. Okay, so this is what I'll conclude with. And I'll wish you a lot of light and a lot of joy.